Welcome to episode 6 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
Today is our big episode.
Our big night out.
That's right. We're reviewing three films with the word big in them. So we've got some confessionals there. So I had never seen Big Fish, the Tim Burton film.
And I'd never seen the Coen brothers film The Big Lebowski. Yeah,
and then we're going to be reviewing the iconic film The Big Chill. So let's start off with my confessional, Tim Burton's Big Fish.
Okay, so in this 2003 film, Will Bloom, Billy Crudup, is living in Paris with his pregnant wife, Josephine Marion Cotillard, and I hope that French accent's vaguely right. 3 years earlier, at Will's wedding reception, he became estranged from his father, Ed, played by Albert Finney. This confrontation was the culmination of Will's growing resentment of his father's need to claim the centre stage, even at events where the focus should be on Will, such as his own wedding. Ed is a self-educated and self-made man who repeatedly relates extraordinary adventures about his life. In these flashbacks that we see, the young Ed is played by Ewan McGregor, with landscapes and characters that are recognisably Burton-esque in their theatricality and at times gothic splendour. These exaggerations become camouflage for his son, and because Will is unable to believe in his father's life, he feels that he can neither know nor love him. When his mother, Jessica Lang, calls him home because Ed is dying, Will determines to finally learn the truth before it's too late and before he himself becomes a father. The result is one of Burton's more emotionally resonant and grounded films, as we move back and forth between the present and vividly imagined retellings of the past, while Will and we try to see past the exaggerated colour and get to the truth. At its emotional core, this film is about the difficulty of achieving a real and personal relationship between father and son. So, Ricardo, what did you think?
You know, I think I've mentioned this before in an earlier podcast, but I'm...
You're a sucker for father-son stories,
so am I. Father-son stories. And so, yeah, let me put it this way. I like Tim Burton as a filmmaker. I think he's a good filmmaker, but I think he's very hit and miss. It's not as though I'll sort of really ache to watch one of his movies. I think his production designs are always great, but I think they're always lacking something. Whereas this didn't.
I was worried where you were going because I love this film.
Yeah, this had such an emotional heart to it, which I really love. I mean, this had me sobbing just from the early sequences between the father and the son.
I think it's a really grounded film for him.
It really is. I think Ed Wood is an amazing film which he did. That's one of my favourites he's done. I think this was more of a personal story for him, apparently, because apparently his parents had passed away.
Well, I think it was actually a personal story for a lot of people. Mm. So the book, I've forgotten who wrote the novel, but the rights were acquired 6 months before it was printed.
Right.
Because the screenwriter saw an early print and totally related to it, because he himself had lost his father while at college.
Right.
Then the project was going to Spielberg, and Jack Nicholson was going to be cast as the dad, which would have been quite a different film.
Very different film.
But then, for various reasons, it came to Tim Burton. And Burton, as you say, had recently lost his own father and mother in the preceding years and wasn't that close to his own father, apparently.
Mm.
Then I read an interview with Helena Bonham Carter, who was Burton's partner, and she was talking about how difficult it was playing the witch, having to turn up with all the kind of the prosthetics and latex early in the morning when she was pregnant. So she's pregnant with Burton's child. I don't know if it's his first child, but it was, you know, certainly a time of impending fatherhood for him. And one of the main reasons the film got made is because the producer, who was the son of, I think it was Alexander Korda, had a difficult relationship with his father and really brought into the story. So there's a lot going on around the making of this film, which I think really gives it its kind of its oomph, or one of the reasons, because it's grounded with people's own emotional experiences.
And that really comes through. It really shines through. And Albert Finney's amazing in it. Ewan McGregor's fantastic.
Albert Finney actually looks like the fish. Did you notice? That kind of almost the bloated look at times, which I don't know if that was really him or something prosthetic going on. It looked real.
But
there was actually almost kind of a typecasting there.
I love the magical moments of this. I think Billy Crudup's character, the son, is very sort of questioning all his dad's stories, you know, which obviously his dad's peppered with such fantasy and fantastical elements to them, which are beautiful, but they did exist, and people did exist in his world. I loved the Carl the Giant, Matthew McGrory, who passed away only a couple of years after.
I know,
that was made, but I really loved it.
I think the other reason why it's very different to Burton's other films, and maybe it's partly because it sounds like it was an inherited project where he came in at a certain point rather than being the initiator. But you think of other films of his where There's this fantastical stuff going on. There's often, you know, what's meant to be the normal kind of world. So things like Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands. Mm. And yet those normal worlds are quite artificial as well.
They are, but
they're a little bit to one side of reality.
He brought himself back to sort of the Edward Scissorhands territory on this one, because Edward Scissorhands was a bit like this in terms of it too was grounded.
Mm.
It was quite moving as well. Like, unlike, say, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which I found was a very, very cold. I liked it,
but I know I'm in the minority there.
Not getting into Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but it started with computer-generated chocolate. I mean, you really can't do that. It just didn't entice me.
I was very disappointed in his Sweeney Todd, because I'd seen the musical on stage. I had the album. I love the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that film, for me, it disappointed. And again, it started with that kind of animated blood running through cogs, was it?
Yeah.
Machinery of some kind?
That's right, yeah.
But for me, I hadn't seen this film since it first came out, when I saw it, you know, at the movies.
Mm.
And when I first saw it, it was very much an experience of, you know, moving between the ordinary and this really kind of, you know, exaggerated past. Watching it again now, 12 years later, having sort of absorbed that story the second time around, I found I was watching it in a very different way.
Mm.
And there were a couple of things going on for me. One was that as we're seeing certain episodes from this glorious, fantastical past, I was trying to imagine what the reality may have been.
Mm.
So, for example, there's a scene where, you know, Ewan McGregor as the young Ed turns up to woo this woman he's only seen once from a distance.
That's right, yeah.
After that, you know, wonderful scene where time freezes and he brushes aside the popcorn.
Yeah, which is classic. I remember seeing that image in the trailer and thinking this is going to be great. I hadn't not seen it for any reason, but just I hadn't seen it. But I'm so glad I saw this film now, because being a father now, I've watched it in a different light, and I'm happy I've seen it now rather than 12 years ago.
Well, I saw it when I'd been a dad for about 2 years, so I've had my first child, you know, a son, and you know, basically, you know, an infant. And this time around, I'm watching it as I've got a teenage son, and I can actually feel more for the father this time around. Mm. You know, being on the other side of that and, you know, wanting to have that relationship, not quite sure how to do it, maybe being a bit uncool, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is important to acknowledge that Ed is very much a self-made, self-educated man
mm-hmm.
who has this highly educated son who becomes a journalist for a prestigious publication over in Paris, that they are actually from two different worlds.
Mm.
And it's not the figure of the father for some of the things that, you know, from his side of what makes the relationship go askew. But I really, you know, I watched it very differently about that. And one of the things I noticed this time around is, anyone who hasn't seen this film, you might want to stop listening now, but when at the end the father is dying and the son finally enters into his world of telling the stories, he tells his father the story of his father's end.
It is just beautiful.
But what it is, but and I love the scene when he's carrying his father down the riverbank and all
everybody's
these characters
there.
Exactly. But what I noticed was the story that the son chooses to tell a father is actually of his death is actually an echo of the story the father had always told about his birth, which was at that major life event, he escapes down the hospital corridor.
That's right.
Yes. And I'm sure that was deliberate. It must have been. And that rounding out of the son, it's a really profound act of love
mm-hmm.
that he gives his father at the end. Yeah. Would have been nice earlier in his life, but,
yes,
you know,
yes,
he got
right.
there and his father had that from him.
That's right.
It was a gift, it really was.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much in this film.
There's so much in it. Like I said, from the very beginning of the film, I was right there and I was in it. Beautiful fantasy elements, and Tim Burton does them very well.
But
they were subtle. They weren't over the top. And this is the thing. Like he often is. They weren't over the top at all. You almost didn't see the fantasy because it was so subtle. For a purpose.
Yes, indeed. And I really think this is his best film. And I know it's a film. I think people either love it or hate it.
Mm.
But when I say that, what I really mean is that I know that men love it or hate it.
Mm.
I think it's very much a film for men who are fathers and or sons. I'm kind of curious, you know, what would the daughter/mother experience be of this film? I honestly don't know. I wonder if it really is for men. So what did you give it?
I give it a 8.
Yeah? Because?
Yeah. Oh, I just think it's a beautifully rounded film. I think it's beautifully written. There's nobody who's bad in it. The performances are all fantastic. The production is flawless. The fantasy elements work seamlessly. It's not a classic by any means, so I'm not putting it in the 9s or 10s category, but it's a really enjoyable film. And I thought about giving it a 7. I said, no, but it's a very good movie. I, you know, from the start to the finish, it never had me. I was never off it. And
because it's long, it's about 2 hours long.
It is, but all I want from a movie is to be moved by it. And movies don't really do that these days. It's really hard for me to be really moved in a movie these days. And I think the last movie, which we might review later on, but I was finding myself in a lull of films which were moving me. I was going, well, why is this? Then I saw once and I was really moved by it. And I thought, wow, thank God cinema's actually moved me again. And
that might have to be my confession.
Yeah, and this is one which I saw it and I thought, no, this is great because it actually moved me. So I was very happy with that.
If I have a criticism of this film, it's that I think the mother character, Jessica Lange, is just a little bit too second tier, you know, in the story. And mm-hmm. I suspect that maybe that character's meant to be like that because the father is so full of life.
Yeah.
She's kind of the quiet achiever in the background. She's acting as the glue where she can between the father and the son.
Absolutely.
And playing the long game in terms of that coming back around between them. Because, you know, the son worships the father at the start. You know,
yes.
Tell me that story about the witch.
That's
and so
right,
on.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like I would have liked a little bit more about the mother character. But mm-hmm. even so, for me, this is a 10. This is a film that I got so much more and so much different kind of stuff out of watching a second time, as I say, some years later. Mm-hmm. I think it sets itself a fairly simple task in a wonderful way, which is to really look at that whole father-son thing about the role of stories in someone's life, mm-hmm. you know, and the line towards the end that stories become the life. It's what we tell about the person after they've mm-hmm. gone. I think there's so much profound working in this. It really is such a well-constructed film. As you say, you know, it's 2 hours long, but I didn't get bored. I didn't pause it to go to the loo or anything else like that.
No, not at all.
I was with it again. And as you say, and maybe because I knew it was coming, I was getting very moved towards the end. And so for me, this is something which really goes above and beyond. And, you know, maybe one day when you go back and watch it years later, you might boost it up when you have that second viewing. But for me, look, it's a 10.
No, wow. Okay.
And that's Big Fish.
So now we're going to review Greg's Confession, which is the Coen Brothers film, The Big Lebowski.
So tell me about it.
Released in 1998 and written, produced and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, The Big Lebowski is a crime caper film starring the brilliant Jeff Bridges as Jeffrey the Dude Lebowski, a lazy, unemployed pothead with a love of 10-pin bowling, which he plays with his close friends Walter, a crazy John Goodman, and Donnie, Steve Buscemi. Set in Los Angeles, the film begins with him having his carpet peed on and being beaten up in a case of mistaken identity with a crippled millionaire who was also named Jeffrey Lebowski. When the millionaire's young porn star wife, Tara Reid, is kidnapped, he commissions the dude to deliver the ransom and get her back. Of course, the plan goes very bad when Walter sabotages it to try and keep the full $1 million ransom. And it goes on and on from there, moving on through a convoluted plot, complicated by extortion, double crosses, deception, and Russians. But I believe that this madness, it was definitely on purpose. It also stars Julianne Moore as Maud, John Turturro as Jesus, in quite a funny turn, the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, the ever so watchable Sam Elliott, and Tara Reid in a fitting role. A disappointment at the US box office, it received mixed reviews at the time of its release, but has now become a cult classic. What did you think, Greg?
This film changed my life. Not. No, I didn't like it. I sat down to watch it with my wife. She gave up after 15 minutes, and I felt like following her. And it's not often that I give up on a film. If I hadn't, you know, had to watch it for this podcast, turning up and saying I watched the first 15 minutes sounded a bit mm-hmm. rich, I wouldn't have persisted. And when you say it goes on and on, it went on and on.
Mm.
And from the start, almost from the start, I didn't like it. And when it went to fantasy scenes, it felt contrived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very stylish, very Busby Barkley kind of style
times. Yeah, it's beautifully made.
Technically, yes. Mm. But stack that up against the way that Burton did it, for example, in Big Fish. Mm. For me, it's chalk and cheese.
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't... It's big sin, and for me this is probably one of the biggest sins about a film. I think you were saying, you know, for you, when we're talking about Big Fish, for you, a film has to move you.
Yeah.
I did not care about these characters. I really didn't. The only things that I really liked, there were a few moments towards the end that were funny. By then it was too late for me in terms of the film, but there are little moments that were funny, and I thought, that would have been better maybe in a different film. And the ones I'm thinking about were about when he nails a bit of wood into the floor,
yes,
and the door opens the other way,
yes,
and then when he comes back later on, he trips over this
That's
thing.
That's right, yeah.
And when he does that classic detective thing of, you know, colouring in the pad of the pencil to get a phone number address, and it's a pornographic cartoon, basically. That was very funny.
Yes, it was.
But that was the highlight of the film for me.
Look, The Big Lebowski, to me, it really doesn't have a great plot, but I think that's the point. I think Joel Cohen did come out and say that they wanted to do a Chandler kind of story, and how it moves episodically and deals with the characters trying to unravel a mystery, as well as having a hopelessly complex plot that's ultimately unimportant. I think it was the point. I liked the film. I thought Jeff Bridges, I love the dude. I think the dude's awesome. I think he's a great character. And I thoroughly love John Goodman. I think he's that crazy character. I mean, I think these characters are great. You got John Goodman, who's like the father character of those three. You got Jeff Bridges, who's like the mother, and Steve Buscemi, who's like their son. I got into it. I got into the characters, and I found it funny. I thought John Turturro was hilarious.
But I thought that was one of the weakest parts of the whole thing.
I thought he was very funny. I still think it's a weaker Coen Brothers film, because usually they're so strong on plot and story, and usually you really do care a lot about the characters. I mean, Fargo is such an amazing, amazing film. I love Miller's Crossing.
I really like The Hudsucker Proxy, which I don't think you've seen.
No, I've never seen that one.
And I loved Raising Arizona. I haven't seen a lot of their films. But I actually want to flip what you said, and this is one of the reasons
Burn After Reading, even. You cared about more of the characters.
In which one?
Burn After Reading.
All right. I haven't actually seen all of that. But anyway, I want to flip what you said, because for me this is actually one of the problems I had with the film. Mm. And this might be one of these filmmaker-film-watcher distinctions, because, well, as a filmmaker, you're an actor.
Mm.
I think this is an actor's film.
Mm.
I think that John Goodman, probably Jeff Bridges.
Oh, Jeff Bridges, come on. Probably.
Julianne Moore. No, but yeah. Julianne Moore and so on.
Mm.
And John Turturro.
Yeah.
I think they had a wow of a time playing those characters.
They did.
I'm still not sure about the dude, because the dude was so laid back, whereas the others were kind of over the top.
Yeah.
You know, and the Maud character.
Yeah.
Who's doing what Jeff Bridges thinks is yoga after they've had sex to try and get pregnant. I reckon they probably had a great time working that out, you know, scripting, workshopping, improv, whatever they were doing, and then performing those characters. I think they probably had a great time.
Mm.
And to see them do that, you know, I get the craft, I think, as a total non-actor. But as audience, it just doesn't work. And, you know, I didn't care about those three guys, for example. Here are three guys who are supposed to be, you're calling them a family unit, which didn't occur to me. But, I think I get that.
Yeah.
At least symbolically.
Yeah, symbolically.
But they're going through these empty rituals about each other. So, you know, they're supposed to care about each other, but then they haggle over $180 for the funeral.
That's right. Yeah.
When one of the characters dies, don't want to spoil it too much, and end up taking him away in a coffee tin. Or the John Goodman character observes the Shabbat and won't drive or answer the phone because he married a Jewish woman who is divorced. But he maintains that, but it's empty because as soon as he has to give it up, he gives it up.
But there's so much about the plot which is
inconsequential.
It really is. And
if you have a mystery, give me the mystery.
I think there is the problem. I think the first half, I think there's lots of things in the film which don't work, and I think the second half isn't as funny as the first.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was wasted.
Yeah, I mean, look, he was really unknown back then. It was before he did Boogie Nights in the same year, and still he was quite unknown. No one really knew the man's talents really back then, and what an amazing actor he was. I think it goes on too long. Like, I love the first half, and I can watch that quite over and over again because I find it quite funny, but then it just falls away. The character of Donnie, if you've seen the film, it really doesn't have to die. I think some of the jokes in it are very lame, unlike a lot of Coen Brothers films, which the comedy is very clever. I still think the ashes blowing on them gag, you know, has been done to death.
Yeah, I thought the same, pun intended. I thought exactly the same thing. I thought, you know, I know it's going to happen, it's happened,
you know.
Yeah,
Walter really doesn't have to pick the guy, the Jeffrey Lebowski, out of the crippled Jeffrey Lebowski out of his chair.
Oh, that too. Disabled. You know what's going to happen.
I mean, that's really the Naked Gun territory,
which I enjoyed more.
That's not clever. And whereas Coen Brothers usually do clever, and it's usually within the dialogue, it's very clever.
But ultimately, I just didn't care about these guys.
Mm.
So, Hudsucker Proxy, I did.
Yeah.
Raising Arizona, I certainly did.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
Fargo,
I have seen Fargo.
Fargo's amazing.
Yeah, I don't love it, but I like it and I certainly respect it.
Yeah.
But these guys were such slackers. And I have to say, even though Sam Shepard is immensely watchable, what was he doing there? Like, he's the narrator who sort of pops in and out of the story a couple of times.
Yeah.
I wasn't quite sure. Is he meant to be some kind of hallucination of Jeff Bridges? Because no one else really interacted with him, even the bartender, really.
Sam Elliott, yeah.
What did I say? Sam Shepard. That's the player. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know who I mean. Yeah, I know. Sam. Yeah, yes. Sam the cowboy.
Look, you know what? I've always loved Sam Elliott. The first thing I saw him in when I was younger was Roadhouse, and I thought he was awesome in that film. I really loved him in that film. And ever since then, everything he's done, he's so cool. He's such a cool actor.
He is.
He's amazing. So anything he does is so watchable, you know.
But a watchable couple of mini scenes does not make a film.
No, it doesn't. And I think, although I still enjoy it, I can watch it and I go, okay, The Big Lebowski, let's watch it and have a couple of laughs. It's definitely not one of Coen Brothers' best.
I will never watch that film again. Yeah. I have watched Raising Arizona again. I either have watched Hudsucker or I certainly would watch it again.
I watch most of Coen Brothers' films again.
And I would watch Fargo again. But yeah. If I never see this film again, I won't care. I just won't care.
Okay, so this is going to be an interesting rating. What are you going to give this one, Greg?
Well, at the risk of podcast players dropping all around the world, for me, this is a 3.
Okay.
Oh, was it a 2? It's a 2 or a 3. Let's go a 3. I feel a bit generous. And mainly because of those little jokes.
Yeah.
And because, you know, I can appreciate the fact the actors had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
But I was outside the fun
zone. I'm going to give it a 6.
Okay? Really?
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 6. I think technically it's really good, and I quite enjoy it when I watch it. I go, this is not a perfect film, and yeah, there's some problems with it and whatnot.
How often have you seen it?
The third.
Right, okay.
I enjoy the watch. I mean, I know what you say about the fantasy sequence. Yeah, I think you're right with them, but I still enjoy them. I still find them funny.
I just apologise to people. I know this is some people's
top
film.
It is really a cult classic now.
It's just not for me.
So that's The Big Lebowski.
It certainly was.
So I've got a confession, Greg, about the next film.
Do tell.
Which is the iconic film, The Big Chill. I'd never seen it.
But that breaks the rules.
It does break the rules. So please tell me about The Big Chill.
Well, before I do, Ricardo, let me just say, I forgive you. Okay, The Big Chill. When Alex commits suicide, his 30-something college friends come to South Carolina for his funeral. We have local married couple, Sarah and Harold, played by Glenn Close and Kevin Klein, recently divorced TV star Sam, Tom Berenger, disillusioned journalist Michael, Jeff Goldblum, disconnected Vietnam vet, Nick, played by William Hurt, stay-at-home and purposeless mum, Karen, Jo Beth Williams, and lawyer and wannabe mum, Meg, Mary Kay Place. Alex's funeral evolves into their weekend reunion, joined by Alex's much younger girlfriend, Chloe, Meg Tilly. Now, if this sounds like a laundry list of stars, it's because director Lawrence Kasdan assembled a dream cast relatively early in their film careers. For example, this was only Glenn Close's second film and Kevin Kline's third. This iconic, and I agree about the word iconic, Ricardo, it really is, this iconic 1983 film uses a weekend reunion to examine a generation at a crossroads. Baby boomers with buckets of idealism when they were young back in the 60s, but seasoned by the real world of careers, marriage, family, and war. A number of them want what their friends already have, success, marriage, divorce, or parenthood, even if those others aren't sure if that's what they want. Beneath the surface is an unspoken question about Alex. If the best and brightest in their group couldn't cope with the realities of the world, how can they? So, Ricardo, your first viewing, what did you think?
I didn't love it, I must say. I know it's iconic and I know everybody will gasp about, you know, The Big Chill. It's so amazing. And yes, the cast is amazing. And yes, the script's okay, but it was just a bit blah for me. I got a little bit bored.
Is this because I didn't like The Big Lebowski?
No. And it's not a generational thing either, because I can watch so many films. I watch different films from so many different eras. It's not that. I found it was very real. And I love that Kevin Costner is apparently the dead body at the very beginning.
And played other scenes that all got cut.
Yeah, that's right. It was his first film. He'd done
a few indie films, apparently.
Right.
But this was his kind of big shot. And they had a scene that they filmed for the end of the film where they go back and show you Thanksgiving dinner back in the 60s with them all, and him at the heart of it as this charismatic guy, which a performance we'd never seen.
So I was just watching these people talking and it was very real. It was great ensemble in terms of performances. I understood what was going on and it was all fine. But just a little bit blur for me.
I find the performances in this variable. For example, Kevin Klein and Glenn Close, I think, are terrific and totally believable as a couple.
I didn't believe when Kevin Kline and the lady have...
But you know, maybe that is a generational thing, because I saw this when it came out in 83.
Sorry, before I say that, Glenn Close's character and Kevin Kline's character are a couple, and Glenn Close basically says that, you know, gives permission for Kevin Kline to have sex with...
And why do you think she does
friend.
That?
Well, obviously, because their friend, the body clock is ticking and she hasn't had a baby yet, so to give her a baby.
I think it's also her way of making reparation for the fact that she had the affair with Alex.
Yeah, well, like absolutely. That too.
So with those two factors in there, I believe it. But I also think, you know, it's a product of its time. In the early 80s,
I think
that would have been quite a shocking kind of thing in a film.
Yeah.
Whereas now, maybe I'm just a bit more jaded and cynical, but now I think that's less extraordinary.
Mm.
But it kind of, you know, was something that really was a moment in the film. And I know that Mary Kay Place, who plays the lawyer who wants to be pregnant, says that, you know, over the years since, people have come up to her and said, I could totally do that, or I could never do that. You know, there was a something there that people, I think perhaps particularly women, responded to. But I really loved the performance between Glenn Close and Kevin Kline in this. I believe them as a married couple who had history and who were very devoted to each other.
Mm.
And it was interesting because I was watching something that was made 15 years on from the film, so now still 17 years ago, where both Kevin Kline and Glenn Close wanted to play other characters. Jo Beth Williams and Glenn Close both wanted to play of a lawyer who wanted to get pregnant.
Right.
And Kevin Kline wanted to play either the TV star or the journalist because he thought that would be a funnier role.
Mm-hmm.
But Lawrence Kasdan, the director, said, no, I want you two to play these parts. You're basically the father, the mother of the group.
Mm.
And I think that totally worked. However, there were other performances that I felt less convinced by. And the one for me that drags the film down a bit is Jeff Goldblum.
A little bit, I agree.
He's only the comic character. You know, he's trying to decide whether he wants to invest in this nightclub thing or not, and that's kind of his, if you like, dilemma. And he's trying to, you know, basically crack on to the girlfriend of his dead friend.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And that's meant to be humorous, and it is to a point. But all the others actually are trying to deal with stuff that I think is deeper and more convincing. And for me, his character never quite worked. I felt like I was watching Jeff Goldblum rather than the journalist.
No, I agree.
Whereas the others, I would put some in the middle and more towards the great performance, you know, good performance kind of end. Meg Tilly is the one, you know, as the younger girlfriend who's really hard to get a fix on.
Meg Tilly.
Yeah. It's kind of harder to get a fix on who she's supposed to be because she comes across as this kind of space cadet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, her boyfriend is just suicided and she's focused on things like, well, we cleaned up the mess and I really want to be in that limo rather than here. When the friends are all kind of angsty about this friend who killed himself, they don't know why. She's not connected to that.
We never find out why.
We don't. We don't at all. Meg Tilly, that is the actress, came back and said later that, in fact, the Chloe character she thinks is really quite intelligent.
Mm.
I don't think she is, except she is the one who really recognises the pain of William Hurt's character, Nick, the ex-vet, who's had a bit of a job as a radio counsellor and then kind of just lost his way.
And
steps into Alex's shoes.
Mm.
So she, the character, had that emotional intelligence to realise that and almost act as the balm for that. But,
you know, I still think
she's a bit spacey.
I get it. All these characters are coming back in the event of this suicide and of their friend. And it's interesting that Kevin Costner's role got cut and they chose not to put any of that in there. I myself... would have actually liked to have seen a bit of that relationship of the best friend in there, of this wonderful man. I mean, I think I had a bit more of a problem with this, like just like I did with Forget Paris in episode one. You know, with all these friends talking about this guy that's so amazing, but that we never actually in Forget Paris we actually do see him,
you can do that I think quite powerfully. You know, the absent character you never meet, that you get a very strong sense of. But you're right, it doesn't quite work here.
I don't think it does.
Alex is almost like a placeholder.
Yes. I was fine with it for the first, you know, for the first hour, because this is a two-hour film. I found it was fine for the first 25, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and then I started going, okay, and started. I feel like I was hearing the same conversations a bit.
But conversations do go around in circles. And these characters are very...
It's too real.
Chloe says, you know, that, you know, I don't like to talk about my past as much as the rest of you do. And that's what they certainly do. They're in this moment and they're all fixated on their past and where they've gone since and where they go forward. But there's almost a certain kind of smugness at the heart of that as well.
Mm.
You know, about this kind of self-obsession. But, you know, I still think there's something very genuine at the heart of this, that, you know, you reach a point where you've left your youth and maybe a lot of your idealism behind, and mm-hmm. you're going to change the world. And most of them have been very successful in what they set out to do.
That's right.
But it's not kind of flowering the way that they thought it would, and that they would be and do the kind of things and people that they thought they would be.
But I got all that. I really got all that. But I still felt something was lacking, and I felt like it was getting very repetitive by the end. And then it suddenly ended. And what really happened? And
they decided to stay. Well, that's a joke. You know, But you know, I'd be quite intrigued now that given that this film was made, 32 years ago. Mm-hmm. So that's a generation. I wouldn't mind seeing the next reunion as a film, like a sequel kind of thing.
Like a bit of a Before Sunrise, Before Sunset.
Well, maybe. But all these actors are in their 60s now, between about 62 and 68, I think I worked out. So they're very much now, they would be the grandparents.
Yeah.
And so there's the scene where Glenn Close is talking to her unseen daughter and saying, you know, being the mother, and then she hangs up and says to her friend, the lawyer, you know, I can't believe what I say sometimes. Mm. But in that conversation, she says to the daughter, well, when you grow up and you're a mother, you can be mean too. And I, at that moment, I thought, yeah, I'd like to see that film now.
Yeah.
The Unseen Daughter, who you may or may not see in the sequel.
Was there talk of a sequel at all?
I don't think I've ever heard of that.
Yeah.
But
it'd be interesting.
But, you know, the other thing about this is that Lawrence Kasdan, who co-wrote the screenplay as well, I mean, he very much found a group of actors who were on their way.
Yes.
And who most of them really are, you know, they're A-list kind of actors, not just in a celebrity sense.
No,
you know.
Yeah.
You think about it. William Hurt, Kevin Kline, Glenn Close.
Tom Berenger.
Yeah, I'm not sure about him, actually. Jeff Goldblum.
He still hasn't had a good career.
Yeah, but, I mean, they're all names that you would know now. Not so much Joe F. Williams, not so much Meg Tilly or Mary Kay Place.
That's right.
But a lot of them are really, you know, well-known actors. And as these actors have done TV and theatre, you know, mm-hmm. TV to a point, but for some of them, it really was one of their very early films. And they're getting used to the process of filmmaking mm-hmm. and working in that world, whereas Glenn Close would have made, dozens of films now?
Dozens, yeah, all of them, really. I'm not saying I disliked it. I'm going to give it a 6. I know it's iconic. I know people rave about this film, and they really do. I was like, oh, my God, they gasp if I say I hadn't seen The Big Chill. It's... What? It's amazing. And
you know, I wonder if it's the film or the idea of the film. You know, I come back to that again, that word iconic. It really was, and Big Chill became shorthand for a reunion of people in their adult years from their young adult years. And I remember when I got married interstate, and a lot of my uni friends all stayed at this other place, and I would have loved to have been there with my friends, but, you know, it was kind of my wedding.
Mm.
But they all talked about it as being, it was a big chill for them.
Right.
Just before I get the score, I just want to talk about one other character in the film, and that's Joe Beth Williams' husband, the one who's only a character for the early part of the film.
Yes, Richard.
Richard, thank you. Oh, you'd know that.
Yes.
Lucky your name wasn't Sarah. Anyway, so the he's actually a minor character in the film, and one I'd totally forgotten when I last saw it, you know, decades ago. But, you know, he struck me this time around that he was very much on the outer of the circle. And when he makes that comment in the car coming from the funeral to his wife about none of those people are as I imagine them, you talk about them, I imagine them very differently. And, you know, he kind of almost as a throwaway line, he says, and I wonder, you know, how do you talk about me to them? And she rolls her eyes out the car window, and you know straight away what that relationship's like.
Yes.
And if they'd ended there, that would have been kind of a comic throwaway part. But there's a scene in the kitchen when he's up in the middle of the night with William Hurt and Tom Berenger, I think.
Yeah.
And he's making a sandwich because there's insomnia, and he values his home life, which his wife doesn't, but he values that home life, and he... You know, he has to do things he doesn't really want to do, but he's made that compromise in a way that the others, the seven friends haven't.
Mm.
And I thought his character in that mix was actually some of the most interesting part of the film this time
around.
Yeah,
I agree.
And so, look, overall, I'm going to give this an 8. It's iconic. You can't get away from that. I think it really does speak to a particular stage of life. I agree with you. There's a certain problem with depth, and I find, for example, Jeff Goldblum's performance kind of takes me out of the film a little bit, you know, believing the story. So that's why I sort of bring it down a bit.
I mean, I think he does okay with the character. I just think it's...
And yet Kevin Kline wanted to play that, you know, as a comic piece.
Yeah.
So, look, I... Yeah, so it's an 8. I think it's a very good film, but it's maybe not executed as well as maybe could have been the case.
I would not watch it again. I don't think I'd watch The Big Chill again.
Oh, I think I would, but I wouldn't go my way to see it.
Yeah, I just wouldn't revisit it. And that to me says everything. If I see a film, I'm like, okay, then would I revisit it or not? And I don't have to revisit every film, but some of these iconic classics, I definitely think I should revisit it or watch it again. I don't think I will.
Well, I say maybe in a way, you know, in some ways, it is a prisoner of its time.
Mm. Oh, I think so. I think definitely. So the next episode, we are changing tact a little bit.
This is going to be a celebration, and a celebration not least of you being a filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah. Look, a film I've produced has been selected into the LA Femme International Film Festival, which celebrates women in film. So we've decided to choose three films which are done by women filmmakers.
Exactly. And different sorts of films too.
Yeah, very different genres as well, and very different takes on them. So the first film we've chosen here is a film called The Kids Are Alright, which is directed by Lisa Cholodenko.
Which is a drama.
It's a drama, yeah.
And then we're going to a lighter film, Pride and Prejudice, which is the kind of Bollywood remake of Pride and Prejudice, yeah, directed by
Kurinder Chatter. And then we're going to something a bit more dark, Zero Dark Thirty by Catherine Bigelow.
We know it's dark because it's got dark in the
title.
That's
right. Three very different films by three very different female directors.
And two which I haven't seen before. I have seen Pride and Prejudice. I have not seen the other two. What about you?
I've seen Pride and Prejudice and Zero Dark Thirty. So
Kids Are Alright is new for you.
That's new for me.
Oh, we'll see how we go.
That's right. So on to the next episode.
Indeed.